A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He and Hanno were driving between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, and they hit that stretch where cellular coverage just vanishes for a few kilometers. Two tall hills on both sides, and one in front, and suddenly you're in a dead zone. He's asking how cellular coverage actually works when terrain gets in the way, whether newer spectrum bands can hug the Earth's surface better than the ones we've been using, how engineers keep tunnels connected underground, and what happens to reception as our cities go vertical. It's a good set of questions, because we all experience dead zones and just sort of shrug at them.
That stretch between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, I know exactly where he means. It's almost a geological middle finger to cellular engineers. You've got hills that form what's essentially an RF shadow, and no tower placement can fix it without putting one right in the middle of that road cut. Which is expensive, and nobody wants to do it.
The geological middle finger. Somebody get that on a plaque.
Here's the thing. Most people think about cellular coverage the way they think about Wi-Fi. More bars equals closer to the tower, and that's almost completely wrong. What actually determines whether you get a signal is something called link budget. It's an accounting exercise. You start with how much power the tower transmits, you add up every single thing that eats away at that power. Distance, obstacles, atmospheric absorption, the noise floor of the receiver. And if what's left is above the minimum the phone needs to decode the signal, you're connected. If not, you're in a dead zone. And terrain is the biggest eater of link budget there is.
It's not just hill block signal. It's that the hill ate enough of the budget that the math no longer works.
And the physics is pretty unforgiving. The frequencies used for cellular, especially the mid-band and high-band stuff everyone's excited about for 5G, are essentially line of sight. They don't diffract around obstacles the way lower frequency signals do. A hill isn't a suggestion to a 3.5 GHz signal, it's a wall.
Which gets to the first part of the question. Can newer spectrum developments change this? Can we make 5G signals hug the terrain the way low-frequency AM radio does?
This is where we need to talk about what hugging the Earth actually means, physically. AM radio operates around 500 to 1700 kilohertz. Those wavelengths are hundreds of meters long. A 600 kilohertz signal has a wavelength of about 500 meters. When that wave encounters an obstacle smaller than its wavelength, like a building or a hill that isn't enormous, it basically flows around it. This is called diffraction. It also reflects off the ionosphere at night, which is why you can pick up AM stations from halfway across a continent.
Cellular is doing none of that.
None of it. A typical 5G mid-band signal at 3.5 GHz has a wavelength of about 8.5 centimeters. That signal does not bend around a hill. It doesn't even bend around your head, which is why holding your phone wrong can drop a call. So when people say, why can't 5G be more like AM radio, the answer is, because then it wouldn't be 5G. The whole reason we use those higher frequencies is bandwidth. You can't shove gigabit data rates through a 500 meter wavelength. The information capacity is proportional to the frequency.
Trade-off between reach and throughput.
That's the entire history of wireless communications in one sentence. Every generation moves to higher frequencies to get more bandwidth, and every generation sacrifices coverage area and obstacle penetration to do it. 2G at 900 MHz could cover a rural area with a single tower. 5G at millimeter wave, 28 GHz, 39 GHz, can be blocked by a tree leaf. A wet tree leaf specifically, because water is an excellent absorber at those frequencies.
The tree leaf is the geological middle finger of millimeter wave.
I'm going to start a collection of these. But to answer the question directly, no, spectrum developments are not going to make cellular signals hug terrain better. The trends all point in the opposite direction. We're moving higher in frequency, which means more line of sight dependence, not less. What's actually happening is we're compensating with infrastructure density rather than signal propagation physics.
Instead of one tower that reaches everywhere, you put towers everywhere.
or you put the towers underground, which brings us to the second part of the prompt.
How do you get a signal inside a long undersea tunnel? You can't exactly put a cell tower at the bottom of the ocean.
You don't. You put the cell tower inside the tunnel. The technical term is distributed antenna system, or DAS, but that's underselling it. In a tunnel, the Channel Tunnel, the tunnels under the Alps, the Big Dig in Boston, you don't rely on external towers at all. The tunnel itself becomes the antenna infrastructure. You run what's called leaky feeder cable or radiating cable along the length of the tunnel. It's coaxial cable with small gaps or slots in the outer conductor that allow RF energy to leak out in a controlled way along the entire length.
That sounds like something I'd diagnose in a houseplant.
It's one of those engineering terms that's exactly what it says on the tin. The cable literally leaks radio frequency. And because the cable runs the entire length of the tunnel, you get uniform coverage. No dead zones. The base station equipment sits in an equipment room at one end or at intervals, connected to the leaky feeder, which acts as a very long, distributed antenna.
It's not that the tunnel is somehow transparent to outside signals. It's that the tunnel has its own internal cellular infrastructure.
And this isn't just for tunnels. The same technology is used in subway systems, underground parking garages, airport terminals, stadiums. Any large structure where external signals can't penetrate and where you need reliable coverage for thousands of people. The leaky feeder cable is the unsung hero of cellular infrastructure.
How far can you run one of these before the signal degrades?
It depends on the frequency and the cable specifications, but typically you need signal boosters or additional base station units every few hundred meters to a kilometer. For something like the Channel Tunnel, which is about 50 kilometers, you'd have multiple segments, each with its own signal source, all synchronized so your phone hands off seamlessly from one segment to the next as you travel through. Your phone doesn't know it's underground. It just sees what looks like a series of cell sites and hands off between them the same way it would above ground.
The handoff actually works? Because above ground, handoffs fail all the time.
They work better in tunnels, counterintuitively. Above ground, your phone sees signals from multiple towers bouncing off buildings, fading in and out, and the handoff decision is based on signal strength measurements that can be erratic. In a tunnel with a properly designed leaky feeder system, the signal is completely controlled. The engineers know exactly where the handoff boundary is, and they can tune the overlap zone precisely. It's a more engineered environment, so it actually performs better.
That's a rare example of underground infrastructure being more reliable than above ground.
It's the same principle as why subway trains run on time more reliably than buses in mixed traffic. When you control the environment, you control the outcomes.
For the Jerusalem to Tel Aviv road, if they ever decided to tunnel through those hills instead of going over or around them, the cellular coverage inside the tunnel would be better than the coverage on the approach roads.
You'd go from a dead zone to perfect coverage the moment you entered the tunnel.
There's something deeply wrong with that.
It's the cellular equivalent of having better Wi-Fi in your basement than your living room, which actually happens more than you'd think, because basements have fewer competing networks.
All right, let's talk about the vertical question. The prompt mentions that GSM antennas have traditionally been tilted horizontally to cover people on the ground, but that assumption is breaking down as cities go vertical.
This is one of my favorite topics because it's a problem that snuck up on the entire industry. For decades, cellular network planning was fundamentally two-dimensional. You modeled coverage on a flat map. You placed towers, you set the antenna tilt, the mechanical or electrical downward angle of the antenna array, to cover the ground, and you called it a day. The assumption was that nobody needed coverage above about the 10th floor.
Because buildings weren't that tall, or because people weren't using phones up there.
When these network planning paradigms were developed, the average urban building was maybe 6 to 10 stories. Anything taller was commercial office space with its own internal systems, and phone usage was primarily outdoors or at street level. Nobody was doing video calls from the 40th floor of a residential tower because residential towers didn't go to 40 floors and video calling didn't exist.
Now we have residential towers going to 80, 90 floors in some cities. Dubai, Shanghai, New York.
The cellular experience on those upper floors is often terrible. Here's why. A typical macro cell site has antennas that are tilted downward. The main beam, where most of the energy is concentrated, points at the ground, usually somewhere between a few hundred meters and a kilometer from the tower. If you're on the 50th floor of a building near that tower, you're above the main beam. You're being served by what are called side lobes, much weaker off-axis radiation patterns that weren't designed to provide coverage.
You're basically surviving on antenna leakage.
And it gets worse. Because you're high up, your phone can see dozens of towers. That sounds like a good thing, but it's actually terrible. Your phone is being bombarded by signals from many different sites, all at similar signal strengths, and it can't cleanly lock on to any one of them. This is called pilot pollution in CDMA networks, and the concept applies to modern networks too. Too many towers, all weak, creates interference that degrades performance.
The view is great, but the signal is garbage.
The penthouse cellular paradox. And it's not just about antenna tilt. At street level, signals bounce off buildings, creating multipath, multiple copies of the same signal arriving at slightly different times. Modern phones are very good at combining these multipath components to reconstruct the original signal. At high altitude, there are fewer reflectors. The signal is cleaner but weaker, and the phone has less to work with.
What's the fix? Are network operators actually changing how they plan for vertical coverage?
They're being dragged into it, is the honest answer. The traditional macro network was never designed for this. The solution, increasingly, is to move the network indoors and upward. Small cells, low-power base stations that cover a single floor or a few floors, are being deployed inside high-rise buildings. These are connected to the building's fiber or Ethernet backhaul and provide dedicated coverage for the vertical space.
You're essentially wiring the building for cellular, the same way you wire it for electricity.
That's exactly the right way to think about it. In new high-rise construction, particularly in markets like the Gulf and East Asia, in-building cellular is part of the spec from day one. The developer runs distributed antenna systems or small cell networks through the building, and every floor gets its own coverage. It's not an afterthought, it's infrastructure, like plumbing.
In older buildings.
Expensive, messy, often resisted by building owners who don't want to deal with the disruption. But increasingly necessary, because residents of luxury high-rises tend to complain loudly when they can't make phone calls, and they're paying enough in rent or mortgage to be heard.
The squeaky wheel gets the small cell.
There's also an interesting regulatory angle here. In many countries, including Israel, there are radiation exposure limits that apply to cellular antennas. When you put an antenna on a rooftop and tilt it down, the main beam doesn't hit people directly. It goes over their heads at street level and hits the ground some distance away. But when you start deploying antennas that point upward into high-rise residential floors, you have to be much more careful about exposure limits. The beam is pointing directly at occupied spaces.
Oh, that seems like a real constraint.
The limits are conservative, far below any level shown to cause harm. But they're legally binding, and they shape how networks can be deployed. In a vertical coverage scenario, you typically use much lower power per antenna and more antennas overall, which spreads the coverage without exceeding limits at any single point.
Which also happens to be better for capacity, because you're reusing spectrum more aggressively.
The vertical coverage problem and the capacity density problem have the same solution: densification. More sites, lower power, closer to the user. Whether you're trying to cover a skyscraper or a packed stadium, the answer is the same.
Let me pull on something you said earlier about frequency and terrain. You mentioned that lower frequencies diffract better. Is anyone actually deploying lower frequency 5G that could help with these coverage gaps?
Yes, and this is where the story gets more nuanced. When people talk about 5G, they usually mean mid-band or millimeter wave, the flashy high-speed stuff. But 5G also operates in low-band spectrum, below 1 GHz. In the US, T-Mobile uses 600 MHz spectrum for what they call extended range 5G. That signal propagates much better than mid-band. It goes through walls. It bends around obstacles. It covers rural areas.
The speeds aren't gigabit.
Low-band 5G is maybe 20 to 30% faster than 4G LTE in the same spectrum. It's not transformative. What it does is provide a coverage layer, a baseline signal that reaches places mid-band can't. Then, mid-band provides capacity where people actually are, and millimeter wave provides extreme capacity in very dense areas.
The network is layered, different frequencies for different jobs.
That's the architecture. It's often described as a layer cake. Low-band for coverage, mid-band for capacity, high-band for extreme density. and carriers are combining these using carrier aggregation, where your phone connects to multiple frequency bands simultaneously and treats them as one big data pipe.
Would low-band 5G fix the Jerusalem to Tel Aviv dead zone?
It would help, but it might not eliminate it entirely. Those hills are significant. Even 600 MHz isn't magic. It diffracts better than 3.5 GHz, but a hill is still a hill. What low band can do is turn a complete dead zone into a zone of weak but usable coverage. Maybe you drop from high definition video to a voice call, but you don't drop entirely.
Which is actually the right design goal. A dead zone is a failure. A slow zone is an inconvenience.
This is where network planning gets interesting from an operator's perspective. Carriers have to decide, do I spend money to cover this stretch of road perfectly, or do I accept that it'll be mediocre and invest that money somewhere with more users? Every coverage decision is an economic decision dressed in engineering clothes.
The prompt mentions that this is a few kilometers of dead zone. How many people are on that road at any given moment?
If it's 1,000 people an hour, maybe it's worth a dedicated site. If it's 100, probably not. And if the geography makes a dedicated site extremely expensive, because you need to run power and backhaul to a location in the middle of a road cut between hills, the economics get worse fast.
The dead zone persists not because it can be fixed, but because fixing it doesn't pencil out.
That's the story of rural and challenging terrain coverage everywhere. The technology exists. The economics don't always support deploying it.
Let's talk about the backhaul problem for a second, because you mentioned it. Even if you put a tower somewhere, you need to connect it to the internet. How do you do that in the middle of nowhere?
Fiber is ideal, but running fiber to a remote hillside is expensive. Microwave backhaul is common, essentially a point-to-point wireless link from the remote site to a site that does have fiber. But microwave is also line of sight, so you need a clear path. In mountainous terrain, you might need multiple microwave hops, each one requiring its own tower and power.
You're building a chain of towers just to connect one tower.
Each hop adds latency and a potential point of failure. Satellite backhaul is an option. Starlink and other LEO constellations are changing this calculation significantly. You can put a cell site almost anywhere now and backhaul it over satellite. Latency is higher than fiber, but for most consumer applications, it's acceptable.
I've seen those Starlink-connected cell towers in remote areas. It feels like cheating.
It's the good kind of cheating, the kind where physics says no and you route around it.
Let's circle back to tunnels for a moment, because there's a safety dimension the prompt raises. Underground infrastructure, especially long tunnels, is a place where connectivity isn't just about convenience, it's about emergency response.
This is critical. In a tunnel fire or accident, first responders need to communicate. Traditional two-way radios often don't work underground for the same reason. Cell phones don't. So tunnel communication systems are designed with public safety as a primary requirement, not an afterthought. In many jurisdictions, it's legally mandated.
What does that look like in practice?
Multiple redundant systems. The leaky feeder cable carries both commercial cellular and dedicated public safety frequencies. Fire, police, ambulance, their radios work on the same distributed antenna system. There's often a separate emergency communication system with battery backup that operates independently of the commercial infrastructure. And in modern tunnels, there are emergency call boxes at regular intervals that connect directly to a control center.
If everything fails, you can still pick up a handset and talk to someone.
The control center can broadcast emergency messages through the tunnel's PA system and override the commercial radio rebroadcast to push instructions to car radios. The engineering around tunnel safety communications is extensive and largely invisible to drivers.
Because nobody thinks about tunnel safety systems until they need them.
If they've been designed well, you never need to think about them at all. That's the goal.
There's a philosophical point lurking here. We expect connectivity to be ambient. Like air, we don't think about the infrastructure until it fails. But cellular coverage is one of the most complex engineered systems ever built, and we papered over that complexity so effectively that a few kilometers of dead zone feels like a personal insult.
The ambient infrastructure problem. It's the same with electricity, water, gas. You only notice the grid when it goes down. And cellular adds a layer of complexity because it's wireless, so people assume it's somehow less engineered than wired systems. But the opposite is true. Wireless is harder. You're fighting physics in ways that wired systems don't have to.
A fiber cable doesn't care about hills.
A fiber cable cares about backhoes and earthquakes and not much else. Wireless cares about everything. Weather, foliage, building materials, the time of day, how many people are nearby, what frequency your neighbor's baby monitor is using. It's a miracle it works at all.
Yet we've built a civilization that depends on it working everywhere, all the time.
Which is why I find the engineering so fascinating. The expectations are impossibly high, the physics is unforgiving, and it mostly works anyway.
Let's talk about something. The prompt gestures at, but doesn't fully unpack. The idea that, as the radio spectrum gets more crowded and we push into higher frequencies, we're essentially relearning lessons that earlier radio engineers already knew. AM radio hugs the Earth. Shortwave bounces off the ionosphere. These were solutions to propagation problems that we're now re-encountering with cellular.
There's a through line in radio history that doesn't get enough attention. Every time we've moved to a new frequency band, we've discovered the propagation behaves differently, and we've had to invent new infrastructure paradigms to compensate. Marconi's early transatlantic experiments used very low frequencies that followed the Earth's curvature via ground wave propagation. Then we discovered skywave propagation in the HF bands, bouncing signals off the ionosphere. Then VHF and UHF came along for television and FM radio, and those were line of sight, so we built tall towers. Then cellular pushed into UHF and above, and we built dense networks of shorter towers. Now millimeter wave is pushing us toward hyper-dense small cell networks.
Each step trades propagation for bandwidth, and each step requires more infrastructure.
The endpoint of that trend is essentially a fiber network with a very short wireless hop at the end. In a dense millimeter wave deployment, the base station might be on every lamppost, and your phone is never more than 50 meters from a site. At that point, the wireless part is almost trivial. It's the wired backhaul connecting all those lampposts that does the heavy lifting.
The wireless network becomes a wired network with wireless edges.
That's already happening in dense urban cores. And it's why the distinction between cellular and Wi-Fi is blurring. Both are just radio access technologies at the edge of a fiber network.
Which brings us to something the prompt didn't explicitly ask, but I think is implied. If the future is dense small cells everywhere, what does that mean for rural coverage? For roads through hills? For the places where density doesn't make economic sense?
This is the digital divide question, and it's not going away. The economics of dense networks work in cities. They don't work in rural areas. So rural coverage will continue to rely on low-band spectrum, macro towers with large coverage footprints, and increasingly satellite backhaul and satellite direct-to-phone services.
Satellite direct-to-phone. That's the new thing, right? AST SpaceMobile. Starlink direct-to-cell.
It's happening now. T-Mobile and Starlink launched their direct-to-cell service in beta earlier this year. The idea is that your existing phone, with no modifications, can connect to a satellite when there's no terrestrial coverage. The satellite acts as a cell tower in space.
This actually works with a normal phone? Not a satellite phone with a chunky antenna?
It works because the satellite is enormous. AST SpaceMobile's Bluebird satellites have a 64 square meter phased array antenna that unfolds in orbit. From the phone's perspective, it's just talking to a very distant cell tower. The satellite compensates for the distance by having a massive antenna and sensitive receivers.
The satellite is doing the heavy lifting, not the phone.
Your phone transmits at the same power it always does, maybe a quarter of a watt. The satellite has to be sensitive enough to hear that whisper from 500 kilometers away. It's an extraordinary engineering achievement.
500 kilometers up and 500 back is a lot of distance for a radio signal.
Low Earth orbit satellites are at around 500 to 600 kilometers. The round trip time for light is about 3 to 4 milliseconds. The processing adds more, so you're looking at maybe 20 to 40 milliseconds total. That's perfectly fine for voice and text. It's not great for competitive gaming, but nobody's doing competitive gaming from a dead zone on a rural highway.
Hopefully not while driving, anyway.
The use case is emergency communication, SMS, basic voice. The kind of connectivity that saves lives when you break down in a dead zone. And for that, 40 milliseconds is more than adequate.
For the stretch of road between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, if a satellite direct-to-cell service were available, that dead zone would disappear.
not with gigabit speeds, not with 4K video streaming, but with enough connectivity to make a call or send a message. And that's the real promise of the technology, not replacing terrestrial networks, but filling in the gaps.
The layer cake gets a space layer.
Low-band terrestrial for rural coverage, mid-band for suburban and urban, high-band for dense areas, and satellite for everywhere else. That's the emerging architecture. And it's genuinely exciting because for the first time, universal coverage is technically achievable. Not just economically justifiable in dense areas, but technically possible everywhere.
The economics of satellite direct-to-cell are different too. You launch a satellite and it covers an enormous area. The marginal cost of covering another square kilometer of empty desert or ocean is essentially zero.
Whereas with terrestrial towers, every additional square kilometer requires more capital expenditure. The cost curves cross at some point, and beyond that, satellite is cheaper.
Let's go back to the vertical coverage question for a moment, because there's a parallel here. Just as satellite fills the horizontal gaps, in-building systems fill the vertical gaps. Both are about extending coverage into spaces the macro network wasn't designed for.
Both are becoming essential as our expectations for connectivity expand. 20 years ago, losing signal in an elevator was normal. Today, it's unacceptable. We've redefined coverage from mostly works outdoors to works everywhere, including 50 floors up and 50 meters underground.
The elevator is a particularly interesting case. It's a Faraday cage moving through a concrete shaft. How do you get signal in there?
Same principle as tunnels, just smaller. You can run leaky feeder cable up the elevator shaft, or you can put a small antenna in the elevator car itself, connected via a traveling cable. Or, increasingly, you just rely on the building's distributed antenna system being dense enough that signal penetrates the shaft walls. In modern buildings with properly designed in-building coverage, yes. In older buildings, elevators are still dead zones. It's a litmus test for whether a building's cellular infrastructure was designed or just happened.
I'm now going to judge every building I enter by whether my phone works in the elevator.
It's a surprisingly good heuristic.
Let's pull on another thread. The prompt mentions that GSM antennas have traditionally been tilted horizontally. Can you explain what antenna tilt actually is and why it matters?
A cellular base station antenna isn't a single omnidirectional rod like you'd see on a walkie-talkie. It's an array of multiple antenna elements in a flat panel. These panels are directional. They focus energy in a particular direction. The main beam is shaped like a horizontal fan that's fairly narrow vertically. By tilting the antenna downward, either physically, by mounting it at an angle, or electrically, by adjusting the phase relationships between the array elements, you control where that beam hits the ground.
Why tilt it down? Why not just point it at the horizon and let it go as far as possible?
1. You want to cover the area near the tower, not 50 kilometers away. Tilting down brings the coverage closer. 2. And more importantly, cellular networks are designed around frequency reuse. You want each tower to cover a specific area and not interfere with neighboring towers using the same frequencies. Tilting the antenna down controls the coverage footprint and reduces interference.
Tilt is a tool for drawing boundaries between cells.
The coverage area of a cell is shaped by antenna tilt, antenna height, transmit power, and the surrounding terrain. Network engineers spend enormous amounts of time optimizing these parameters. It's called RF planning and optimization, and it's part art, part science, part black magic.
When you add vertical coverage to the mix, you're adding a third dimension to what was previously a two-dimensional optimization problem.
Which makes it dramatically more complex. Now you're not just asking, does this point on the map have coverage? You're asking, does this point at this altitude have coverage? And is it getting interference from towers that are 50 kilometers away but have a clear line of sight because they're both at altitude? The interference patterns become three-dimensional.
The network planning tools have to model the city as a 3D volume, not a 2D surface.
They increasingly do. Modern RF planning tools use 3D building data, digital elevation models, and ray tracing algorithms to simulate how signals propagate through urban canyons and up building facades. It's computationally intensive. A single citywide simulation can take hours or days to run.
Like what they use for computer graphics.
You simulate millions of rays emanating from each antenna. bouncing off surfaces, penetrating materials with some loss, and you calculate what arrives at each point in the 3D grid. It's the only way to get accurate predictions in complex urban environments.
I imagine the margin for error is small. A building that's 20 stories in the simulation, but 22 stories in reality, could cast a shadow that the model didn't predict.
This actually happens. Building data is often outdated or inaccurate. A new construction that isn't in the database yet can create unexpected dead zones. Network operators have teams that drive around measuring actual coverage and comparing it to predictions. When they find discrepancies, they adjust the model or the network.
I've seen those cars with the antennas on the roof.
That's exactly what they're doing, measuring signal strength, call quality, data throughput, handoff performance. And increasingly, they're also using crowdsourced data from users' phones, anonymized, aggregated measurements that provide a real-time view of network performance.
Your phone is constantly feeding data back to the network about coverage quality.
It's a two-way relationship. The network serves your phone, and your phone helps the network understand itself.
There's something almost biological about that.
The comparison to a nervous system isn't far off. The network senses its environment through user devices, adjusts its parameters, and routes around damage or congestion. It's a distributed, self-optimizing system.
Which is why it mostly works. And why the failures, when they happen, are in places the nervous system doesn't reach.
The hills between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. The 50th floor of an old high-rise. The elevator shaft. The places the network forgot.
All right, let's bring this together. The prompt asks three questions. 1. Can spectrum developments overcome line-of-sight limitations? Answer, no. The physics pushes the other way, but we compensate with infrastructure density and layered frequency strategies. 2. How do tunnels get coverage? Answer, leaky feeder cable and distributed antenna systems that make the tunnel its own cellular environment. 3. How is vertical coverage changing? Answer, slowly. Through in-building small cells and 3D network planning, driven by the fact that cities are growing upward and people expect connectivity at every altitude.
That's a clean summary. I'd add that the through line across all three is the same. Coverage gaps are not technology problems anymore, they're economic and infrastructure problems. We know how to fix them. The question is whether the cost is justified.
Whether the regulatory environment allows it. Permitting for new cell sites, especially in environmentally sensitive or historically significant areas, can take years.
That's a whole other episode. The intersection of cellular infrastructure and local politics is a deep and frequently frustrating topic.
One thing I want to touch on before we wrap. The prompt mentions that this drive was with his wife Hannah. I appreciate that he's the kind of person who, when his phone loses signal, doesn't just sigh and move on. He looks at the terrain, maps the hills, and sends us a prompt about RF propagation.
The world needs more people who respond to minor inconveniences by asking how the underlying infrastructure works.
It's basically the ethos of this show.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1920s, it was customary for ships wintering in the Hudson Bay near Nunavut to paint their hulls with a mixture of seal oil and charcoal, not for preservation, but because sailors believed it made the vessel look unappetizing to walruses, which they feared would mistake the ship for a rival and ram it.
The Walrus Threat Assessment Protocol.
New fear unlocked. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumintop. If you want more episodes, find us at My Weird Prompts. Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. Next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.